WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Indiana State Police say three people have died in an apparent tornado in Winchester. Tornadoes have also been reported in Kentucky and Ohio. In Texas, golf ball-sized hail. In Colorado, snow as much as 2 to 3 feet near the Denver area.
I love when the door opens and it's just, you know, you're pushing it out of the way of the door.
The verdict for James Crumbly, the father of the Oxford, Michigan high school shooter.
Count one, involuntary manslaughter as to Madison Baldwin. Guilty of involuntary manslaughter as to Madison Baldwin. Count two, involuntary manslaughter as to Tate Mirror.
Crumbly is found guilty on all four counts for not locking up a gun and not addressing his son's mental health. His wife, Jennifer, was found guilty of the same charges last month. Their son is serving a life sentence. CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
For Civic Media News, I'm Nate Wiggehoe. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Governor Evers signed 15 bills into law on Thursday. Among the new bills is an expansion of the state's Clean Water Fund program. That program helps to make sure communities have everything they need to keep their drinking water safe. The money can be used for everything from treating PFAS to upgrading wastewater systems. Other bills signed into law clarify hunting and fishing regulations and update electronic recycling rules. A Superior-based Catholic charitable organization is not exempt from paying unemployment taxes. The Wisconsin Supreme Court made the ruling against the Catholic Charities Bureau Thursday. While religious groups are usually exempt from paying taxes, the court found that because the work they did was secular in nature, they still had to pay. Attorneys for the group say that they intend to appeal the ruling directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Nate Wiggehoe, Civic Media News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. 93.5 The Tap.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Journalist John Harwood had an interesting tweet talking about, you know, how the mainstream media is, well, in his estimation, incorrectly covering this election cycle. And his tweet was great. He said, voters don't want this is the wrong frame. First, it's incorrect. Voters could have chosen other nominees and didn't. Second, he said, half, you know what, backsided. Do you like these two politicians? Poll question doesn't yield useful information. He said the nominees are night and day different. Cover the difference. And this is the part where this isn't sexy. Covering the difference, the policy. Do we want to talk about policy in this country? Do we want to accurately report what each side, red hat, blue hat, Trump, Biden, do we really want to know what they think? Or is it better to go, you know, Joe Biden's old? Well, so's Donald Trump. Do we want to just, you know, be force-fed the horse race? Or do we want to talk about what each of these two are going to do? What the parties are moving toward? What values? What vision? And for me, as a policy person, I want to know how you're going to make my life better. I want to know how you're going to make the lives of working people and their children. How you're going to make that better. We saw Donald Trump during his 4 years do nothing for working people. A lot for corporate America. The tax cut did really well for them. I know I know working people got a nibble, but that goes away. That sunsets. Corporate America did really well. And he's promised to go even further in the next term. He's promised to weaponize government against clean air and water and all of the things that I think we want and need. So for me, this is a unique opportunity. We're not going to spend the summer, you know, fighting over who's going to be the nominee. You know, there's not going to be that horse race. And instead of being force-fed the horse race of, you know, who can stutter the most or who stumbles over words or who's cognitively, you know, not there, how about we talk about policies? Because understand, you know, the president is one guy of the apparatus. The parties, the vision of the parties that each of them have, I think is just as important. And as the head of those parties, Biden and Trump, the head of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, they have, I hope, both have a vision of what the future looks like. Now, remember, 2020, the Republicans did not have a platform. Nothing. They, you know, before every convention, the party puts out, these are our values. This is our agenda. This is what we want to do. The Republicans just said, nah, whatever he wants, whatever dear leader wants. And I doubt they're going to come out with one now that Laura Trump is the co-chair of the RNC. I doubt that there'll be a values statement then, other than we're going to pay back. We're going to go get all retribution. So, you know, for me, the idea of, okay, we got two old guys. We got what we wanted. We wanted the rematch. Republicans could have made a different choice. A Democrat could have come up and you could have voted for Dean Phillips. It's Biden, it's Trump. Those are our choices. Now you're going to get a lot of, there's a third party. No. One of those two guys is going to be president in 2025. January 20th, 2025, one of those two guys is going to put their hand on the Bible. Going to swear that they're going to uphold and defend the Constitution and also to move the country and defend the Constitution, which general welfare, all of the we the people, that kind of stuff. So I thought it was interesting, you know, that maybe we talk about just a little bit the differences between the two of them. On, let's say infrastructure. Trump ran on going to rebuild infrastructure. In fact, I remember him talking about a $3 trillion plan, never materialized, never put any muscle behind it. Had infrastructure week a lot. Had lots of cartoon photographs and lots of PR stunts. No actual work that got done. Biden actually passed an infrastructure bill. We're rebuilding infrastructure. We're investing in the future. So do we want words or do we want action? I prefer action. On the manufacturing front, Trump, same thing. Manufacturing week. We're going to have all this manufacturing return. Don't move, people of Lordstown. The GM plant there will stay. Well, it went belly up. Trump talked a lot about manufacturing. Did we reshore manufacturing? No. Biden actually had a policy to bring jobs back. And we're doing that. Labor rights. Workers, if you can't see the difference between the two, you got one guy who marched on a picket line and supported workers with a Department of Labor secretary and a National Labor Relations head that actually cares about working people. Or you've got the Trump side, who the head of the Department of Labor was a corporate attorney who attacked labor. An NLRB that did everything they can do to make sure that nobody brings cases before them because nothing but bad stuff would happen. And you can go down the list. Health security. Yeah. They had a great plan. They were going to repeal and replace Obamacare. Said they had a great plan. Never saw it. Never heard anything about it. Retirement security. You had Trump on Monday morning say that he's all in favor. We're gonna cut Social Security. And this is where, again, we should have a media that says, hey, wait a second. That's a difference. This is maybe a reason that you vote one way or the other. Bodily autonomy. Trump has said, look, I'm the guy who overturned Roe versus Wade. Biden saying, hey, women should have the ability to make their own choices. We are in a moment where the differences could not be more different. And John Harwood hits on this perfectly. cover the differences, cover the policies and the policy choices, because ultimately that's what we want. I know the pie fight is all fun. I know the horse race, the team sports stuff. Yeah, that gets people riled up. But you know what makes people's lives better? Actual policy. Actually getting things done, which our Republican friends have made it very clear. They're not interested in making people's lives better. They're not interested in policy. You know, I was just thinking about the Rick Scott, the last policy piece that we saw come out of Republicans was the Rick Scott 11-point plan. You know, one of them was, we're going to have children say the Pledge of Allegiance every day, but we're not going to get them a school lunch. and it just got worse from there. We're going to sunset all government policies and all bills, everything, every 5 years. So Social Security and Medicare, maybe it gets reauthorized, maybe it doesn't. These are their policy chops. This is the stuff that they want us to vote for them. Now remember, no platform in 2020, no policy chops to speak of, the most do-nothing Congress in the history of our country, just about. Not even messaging bills. Not even that these are our values kind of bills. So for me, this election is pretty simple. Should be really simple. The guy who does have a vision, and Biden laid that out in the State of the Union, that things are getting done, we are moving in a positive direction, that we're working. As opposed to the Republicans who tell us government can't do anything, and then go out and prove us that government can't do anything by breaking everything. So for me, this is one of those things, and this is where Harwood doesn't understand, that you know the media is not going to cover the differences. They're going to cover the horse race because the Republicans, there's nothing to talk about. If you were to report honestly, you'd say, well, Republicans have nothing. But they're not going to do that. So we're going to get stuck with Biden's old. And all of the, someone tripped on the carpet. You ready for it? Quick break, right back. When we come back, Alex Lawson's going to be here from Social Security Works talking about a difference between the two and the two parties. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Monday morning, Donald Trump was on Squawk Box, up early for the Squawk Box, and said the quiet part out loud. Yeah, he wants to cut Social Security. And now, what the weird thing is this is a guy who's always walked the line, always told old people what they wanted to hear. That oh no, we're not going to do that. And interestingly enough, on the day that Biden comes out with his budget that says, hey, we're going to expand benefits, Trump is saying now, well, we're going to cut. Here to share some thoughts on what that cut could be. Why now? I've asked our good friend Alex Lawson to come talk with us. Alex is the executive director of Social Security Works, our website, socialsecurityworks.org. Alex, thanks for taking time for us.
Always, Rick. And it is a news-filled morning for me. So I'd love to dive right into that, although I think you covered the reason that he was asked on Squawk Box is because President Biden was releasing his budget today. And so it's in the news. And I think I think your lead-in of saying it was 6 a.m., I think Trump accidentally told the truth, which is what happens with politicians when they're lying all the time, right? We've said, I've said on here with you, and you know, when Trump was president, he cut Social Security. He proposed cuts to Social Security every single budget that he put out. It's just he knows that, you know, when he gets on TV, he's supposed to lie and not say that part. But because it was Squawk Box, so he's talking to money people, and it was so early in the morning, he just said it. You know, he said, yeah, there's a lot we can do with cuts. And he always previously has like left himself some word soup enough that he could say, oh, that's not what I meant. But there's no way around the way the question was asked. You know, what about entitlements? And then he named them Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. So we know exactly what he's talking about. And then Trump's response directly on entitlements, there's lots we can do on cuts. No way around that, right? That's what Donald Trump, and it's sort of obvious to me, but I hope it's obvious to more people now. This is where the Republicans are. They want to cut Social Security benefits so they can give tax handouts to their billionaire paymasters, and the Democrats want to tax billionaires and protect Social Security from all cuts and actually expand benefits. That choice is incredibly clear.
But the weird thing is, and again, we're in this red hat, blue hat world, where if you ask the, one of the red hats, do you think Trump said that? They're going to say, no, he's a defender of Social Security. And then they would then turn it and say, no, it's Joe Biden, who during the State of the Union address said he would never cut it. It's we're in this upside down world where what is true and what is believed are two very different things in most cases.
I think that's right. But I also think like what Trump sort of learned in his multiple verdicts against him and judgments against him when, you know, now he is actually needed to find 80 something million dollars and hundreds of millions more. It's one thing to craft a narrative and like especially with friendly media, you know, like it's fully bought and paid for right-wing corporate propaganda. It's not media, but when Fox is just the tip of the iceberg of their operation, he can spin any narrative he wants, but it's sort of different when you do have the tape of him saying the words, right? And he's saying, I'm going to cut Social Security. And then Biden is out there saying, I fought pharma and now Medicare can negotiate drug prices. And you ask people about that, and they love it. And then they unprompted say, I just got a free shingles vaccine. You know, I just got this other free vaccine. Things that they know tangibly that President Biden has done. When Donald Trump was president, it's easy to craft a narrative when it's like, oh, all the things I will do, like when he first ran. But he was president.
Right.
He had time where he did things. And the things he did was he put the arsonists in charge of Social Security and handed them a tank of gas and a thing of matches. Those are his actions, not his lies.
Now, the thing that I think is important remembering, you know, Trump's budgets all called for cuts to Social Security and Medicare, right?
Every single one of them, because that's Republican orthodoxy, right? And you know that. And I do think that it's widely not understood, which is why they, you know, last State of the Union, the Republicans went nuts when Biden just accurately described what they are doing and what they're ethos is. One of their North Stars is the destruction of Social Security. But, and what you're describing is also what they know. It's actually that if you go out into America, it does not matter who you're talking to. A MAGA hat wearing, you know, person in wherever, or a riding with Biden person wherever, does not matter. Geographically, demographically, everyone loves Social Security. And so the political party that is connected to destroying it needs to do everything in their power to not let that story get out to the American people. But narrative is not truth. And that's the thing, Rick. You're a truth teller, right? Like, you know that you can look and you can find what is actually happening. And the Republicans who don't believe that Donald Trump put Mick Mulvaney in charge of figuring out ways to dismantle Social Security, like, they're wrong. That is the truth. And we do need to just get that story out there as widely as possible. And the way to do it, we do our part, but the way to do it is for Biden to pick that fight, like he did in the budget. And he said, this is our moral vision on Social Security, on Medicare. This is our moral vision for the future of the country. What's your vision? And Donald Trump responded, I want to cut Social Security. That's his moral vision, so he can give another tax handout to billionaires.
You know, what do you say to the argument, though, that, you know, this is, and I've made this argument in the past as well, that, you know, if Biden's for it, Trump's got to be against it. If Biden's against it, Trump's got to be for it. It's the binary of the red hat, blue hat. You know, what do you say to that argument, that that's the reason that he came out? Look, he's always wanted to cut it. It's been part of his budgets, as you've laid out. It is the Republican on their wet dream wish list from the day of its inception until today. But what do you say that this just came out because if Biden said during the State of the Union, like he did, I'm going to be the one who protects it, Trump's got to be the one who destroys it.
I think there's a lot to that. I also think that Social Security is sort of unique because the numbers are so wildly, it's 90%. 90% of people, Republican in America, 90% of Americans, Republicans, independents, Democrats, all say absolutely not one penny of cuts to Social Security. This is where I always make the joke that far more people in America believe in the Loch Ness Monster than want to cut Social Security, according to public opinion polling. So yes, there usually is that. They sort of, if you're for it, we're against it, and vice versa. But on Social Security, Donald Trump, I expect him to actually react each time he is accused of wanting to do what he does want to do, cut Social Security. He will try to just dissemble. He'll try to talk his way out of it. And if you listen to the whole Squawk Box interview and you can put up with his word soup, you know, word jumble thing he does, you can tell he is trying to do that.
Yeah.
He's trying to give a wink and a nod, like, yeah, there's a lot we can do on cuts. And then he pivots right into the just tired Republican talking points of waste, fraud, and abuse, right? Like that he's trying to do the two-step. But he was too slow today. I think he's got a lot on his mind.
Yeah, I made the mistake of reading the transcript. I didn't want to watch it. I wanted to read the transcript. That's really hard.
Yeah, you're like
none of it. Like, I mean, I had to read some of it
thrown at a paper.
Yeah, exactly. I had to read it a couple of times to go, how does this make any sense? And look, you know, I've gotten accustomed to Trump speak. So, you know, when you hear it, you go, well, he's just blathering on. But when you read it, wow. I mean, that's the part that got me, because in the paragraph that he was talking about cutting Social Security, there came up a Regeneron, the 1929 Depression. I mean, there was just, like you said, a bunch of words thrown at a page without much rhyme or reason. It was disconcerting. I mean, it was bizarre.
I don't know if you saw, this is a digression, but if you saw Jimmy Kimmel read the attacks on him from Trump, I mean, it was the same thing, right? Like, if you sit there and read it, you're like, whoa, what is this even? Like, this is beyond incoherent. I do think there is, you know, malice behind it. I think he has, for a long time, he just throws so many words that people hear what they want to hear. And he has, you know, his base who will believe, and then he will clean it up, or he'll have his people clean it up if necessary. So, and in this one, I want him to try to do that. I want his apparatus to come alive and try to pretend that we don't have evidence from his 4 years as a president of what he thinks and what he wants to do on Social Security and Medicare. And Rick, I know you remember this, but just to remind everybody, when he was right before the election, when Biden defeated Donald Trump and became the president of the United States, Donald Trump was promising cuts to Social Security in the second term, right? He was saying to those billionaire donors that he needed, he was saying, I'm going to get to that. And if you reelect me, I'm going to cut Social Security. So that's why he has to do the wink and the nod, is talking to the Wall Street folks that he and all the Republicans rely on for their elections.
As I remember, though, in going back to that, and fortunately, it's a period that I try to forget. I remember the argument is we've got to kill it so we can save it, being the frame of we're really going to protect your Social Security, but first we have to kill it.
Yeah, always. I mean, this is their whole thing, that they being Wall Street and the politicians who dance to their tune. They are like, oh, no, we want you to have a secure retirement. We are the ones who want to protect your future. We just want you to have power over it. And what they mean is we want you to invest your money into Wall Street funds so that we can take extraordinarily high fees and just privatize Social Security, because no one profits off of Social Security. And they see that as a huge mistake. No one's getting rich off of Social Security. It's we pay into it when we can, and it's there for us when we need it. And there's no person in a $8,000 suit taking their percentage off the top. And that's why administrative costs for Social Security are less than 1%, less than one penny of every dollar that you pays in goes to administer the entire thing. And that's what Wall Street, the billionaires, the amount of money we're talking about, Rick, is bigger than anything that they have now, even with all of what they've got. Social Security is the prize. If they can get their hands on it, nothing will make, you know, someone or group of people richer. And we know what happens. We've seen it around the world. Look at Chile. Every time they do this, they have to revert back to a pay-as-you-go system, and it costs enormous amounts of money, and a few people become billionaires. That's what it's all about.
And a whole bunch of people end up suffering because of it. So absolutely. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because I see this as one of those issues, and if you watch the State of the Union or listen to it, the president had two frames that I thought were really important. One, we've got to save democracy, first and foremost, and two, this idea of fairness. That you know the billionaires should pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes than working people. You shouldn't be getting screwed by credit card companies down the list. And this, I think, plays into that fairness argument, that this is something that you worked your entire life for. It shouldn't be subjected to massive cuts, and it shouldn't be pushed off down the road for you to get it maybe sometime further into the future. So I think this is a perfect time for this fight to come up.
I agree. And the you know, like, oh, but it's such a hard problem to solve. And you're like, it is not a hard problem to solve. The billionaires don't pay in at the same rate as everybody else. The richer, the more money you make, the less you pay into as a percentage into Social Security. It's a super regressive revenue formula. It's just the benefit structure is so progressive that the system as a whole is amazing for pulling this country together, unlike income and wealth inequality, which just ripped the country apart. So it's also so simple. All we do is we have billionaires pay more into Social Security, pay the same rate into Social Security as the rest of us, which is deeply fair. And then we can expand benefits for everyone. And the Republicans are like, they see the exact same thing. They know that all that needs to happen is their billionaire paymasters need to pay more. And that's why they're desperate to cut benefits as soon as possible so that the billionaires don't have to pay more in taxes. Joe Biden is proposing a fairness agenda. I agree with you completely. And his actions prove that. Pharma's ripping us off, ripping off the government as a whole, ripping off the people. He took on pharma, and now Medicare can negotiate drug prices. You look at what his FTC is doing when they're hitting monopolies for their anti-competitive behaviors, taking on credit card companies. All of those really do point to an economic agenda that is aimed at working for working people. Everyone will be happy with it except for the billionaires.
Exactly.
And that is a price that we're all willing to pay.
I know I am. But as always, Alex, great stuff. I know you'll be back soon and often as this continues, because I think this is going to be a central issue in this campaign. But I appreciate you taking a little time for us today.
Thanks, Rick.
Our good friend Alex Lawson. Make sure you check out their website over at socialsecurityworks.org. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for The Todd Allball Show.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy tonight, low upper 20s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs to the mid-50s. Partly sunny and breezy for the weekend, upper 40s Saturday, only upper 30s Sunday. Gradual warming trend into the work week next week from near 40 Monday to around 50 by Wednesday. It's 42 right now.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
I ate at gas stations today. You took me to the finer gas station, to the four state area.
You drove, dude. What are you talking about? You're a grown-ass man. You go get yourself a piece of cherry pie, man. What do you want me to do?
Do I look like a roasted turkey to you right now? I know you're hungry. Like the cartoon style?
Oh. You do look like a...
beef? A little piece of bacon, a slab of meat, something?
Oh, yeah.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
On your local civic media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it is Sunshine Week, and not just because the sun is out and it's getting warmer and we're all looking forward to spring and summer and all of that. No, no. Sunshine Week is where we go, hey, you know, how are our tax dollars being spent? How much money are we giving to corporate special interests? You know, how are the lobbying crowd faring at the expense of we the people? And are there examples of us, having a good idea of where our tax dollars go? Which is why I thought it'd be a great opportunity to reach out to our friends over at Good Jobs First. They've got a report out on Sunshine Week and celebrating open government and all of that stuff, which is why I've asked Arlene Martinez to come talk with us. She is the Deputy Executive Director over there at Good Jobs First. GoodJobsFirst.org, the website. Arlene, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
So Sunshine Week, this should be a celebratory time, a time where we're happy and joyful, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it should be and it could be. There are a lot of places that are doing transparency well. That's actually what we decided to focus on this week, were places that are doing transparency right, because we're very critical of the many, many places doing it wrong and hiding how our money's being spent. So, but there are places doing it well.
Yeah. So let's start with Transparency Week. When did this start? And how did it start?
So Sunshine Week started in 2005 by what was then the American Society of Editors. And they got together and they said, let's take a week and really talk and spend the week focusing on how important open government is to democracy and to everything that we hold dear. And it's because of open government and how our money's being spent. Is it being spent well? We can't begin to see if government's working for us if we don't know where the money's going. So they started this week of transparency, and I've been involved with it for many, many years because I was a journalist before I got here.
No, and I think it's important. I think the point of, you know, knowing how our money's spent and what priorities we put on investing or not. And I look at a lot of the corporate subsidies that I've complained about over the years, building stadiums, giving corporations wild amounts of money for I don't know why in a lot of cases. So it's good that people at least 1 week out of the year are focused on this. I wish it were every week of the year. So let's talk about this. Are there states that are doing Sunshine well? Are there states that are doing transparency well, explaining how tax dollars are being used? Are there any states that are doing really well?
Yeah, so we like to think about Sunshine Week as taking place all year round because we're always trying to promote transparency around economic development and these subsidies that you're talking about that go to corporations in the name of economic development. But what does the public really get in return? So a couple of years ago, we did a report scanning 250 programs across the country. Every single state, their most expensive programs we looked at to see how successful they were in terms of transparency. Does the public get to know that a project is coming before them? Do they get to know basic things like the company name or how much money the company is getting or how many jobs they're producing or whether those jobs were actually produced? Kind of what I think is very basic things when it comes to an economic development deal. Those are the questions that we were asking. Now the winner was Nevada, because Nevada does things pretty well. They actually give the public the advance notice. They let people know how many jobs are supposed to come. They let people know the company name and the dollar figure. But even Nevada, that was the best state in terms of transparency, got a 64 out of 100. So you can think about there's still quite a bit to go, even with the best state. On the other hand, you saw Alabama and Georgia. They got scores of zero because it is still not possible to go into like, let's say, Georgia and find a deal without FOIAing for it, with that is without submitting a public requests report. They put up the report for 30 days and then they disappear, and we don't consider that transparency.
Wow. And even in the best case scenario, 64 out of 100, that's still failing where I went to school. So a lot of work to do. But, you know, in talking about these subsidies, and look, I've been critical of the vast majority of them because I think in a lot of cases it's money thrown down the drain. Are there situations where you see, you know, the subsidies where these investments pay off? I mean, you know, recently, you know, Joe Biden's been talking about CHIPS and the CHIPS Act and the investments that are being made there. And I've got a lot of people, you know, questioning me going, Rick, you know, you're against these subsidies. Why are you okay with these? And it's a fair question, I think. I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, so it is exciting to think about all this federal money that are going to what are really exciting uses, right? Bringing back chips production to the United States that had really been outsourced for a long time. And these are jobs that potentially are really good in terms of pay. They're full-time jobs. They're jobs that you could potentially get without a college degree. So there's a lot of good things about putting money into this. Where the problem is where states, on top of all this federal money, lard on a lot of extra money. So in some cases, these federal subsidies are worth billions of dollars for one facility. And then the state pours money on top of that. And the problem, unfortunately, where the federal legislation fell short is the wage and benefit regulations around and requirements for the permanent jobs that'll be created. So you've got these companies that'll get significant amounts of state and federal money without any requirements that the permanent jobs be full-time, that they be living wage jobs, that they have good benefits, you know, all those things that we want of these new jobs that are being created.
Right. No, this is one of the things I give Joe Biden credit for. I mean, you know, the money that's being invested in the infrastructure bill, you know, done under prevailing wage. There are some strings attached to some of the CHIP money to make sure that those are good jobs. And I think, you know, as in any policy, you can write good things in, like we want these good jobs and these benefits for working people and communities. But you can also, I guess, you can write them the other way. And you look at what Georgia is trying to do, saying, look, if you get any state money from us, you can't recognize a union. You have to submit to a secret ballot election and harass your employees, or we're not going to give you a dime. So I guess you can write good things as well as, well, not so good things.
That's right. And that federal legislation, you know, the construction jobs, you're right. They were prevailing wage jobs. Those are going to be great jobs in the construction phase. The problem was with the permanent jobs. And, you know, you mentioned Georgia, but if you heard about the Rivian deal, Rivian, the electric vehicle company, essentially a bit of a startup, got about $1.5 billion from Georgia residents to get this subsidy. And Rivian just pulled out of Georgia saying, well, we probably aren't going to end up going there after Georgia residents had spent quite a bit of money on that. But when you're talking about what states can do to make sure that those jobs that are good, this 20-year agreement called for Rivian workers to be paid $20 an hour in the first year, which isn't too bad. But in 20 years, it still called for it to be $20 an hour because there was no wage increases required under that subsidy. So you're right. They can do it. There are good ways to do these deals with a lot of restrictions and requirements. And then there are too often deals that aren't done with anything at all.
And a lot of them don't have clawback, you know, in them at all. So it's money that if you spend $1 billion, well, you know, better luck next time.
Yes. And I think residents in Wisconsin are experiencing that with the Foxconn deal that did not happen. You'll remember that was a really high profile deal, that the biggest subsidy deal at the time, where the county didn't have very good clawbacks. And so residents there are really hurting because of that.
So, you know, in looking at, you know, with it being Sunshine Week and looking at, you know, what we've been talking about, is there a way to make this better? As you pointed out, Nevada is the best state in the country for this, only getting 64 out of 100. Is there a way, I don't know, for the federal government to set, you know, broad guidelines? Is there a way to enforce this? Or is this a taxpayer thing? Is this, you know, we've got to get angry about something?
Well, I just want to draw your attention to Franklin County in Ohio, where there the auditor made a real conscious decision to put all this economic development subsidy information online. So all the money that the county is losing to tax increment financing, which is a type of a subsidy, three other programs, and he lists every service that is losing money by the dollar figure. So the zoo, what is the zoo losing to these subsidies? What are the schools losing to these subsidies? What do children's services lose? What do mental services lose? So we think about these deals in terms of opportunity costs, and the public can actually begin to have that careful consideration of whether this deal merits it.
We I actually like that. A little corporate shaming.
Yeah, you know, it really kind of is. And if you look at the language of the website, I think he's really, really into having the community consider whether these deals are good for their residents. Think about, this is what you're giving up, right? That's what a dashboard like that shows you. We think a lot of this is because it's a state enabling a legislation that allows for all these subsidies to be given out. States are the ones that really need to be saying, and they have the power to say, we're going to have these transparency portals. We're going to have these requirements to submit information about how many jobs are created, what kind of wage requirements you have, or even better, you know, ensuring that the jobs that are created are good and tracking those outcomes. But probably the state level is where we think a lot of this action needs to happen.
Yeah, and I like the idea of, you know, of being able to see, you know, what's being spent, where it's being spent, how it's being spent, what the outcomes are, because then you can start to have conversations around, you know, is it worth it? You know, I remember for a while, and I don't know if it's still going on, but I look at, you know, Kansas and Missouri seem to be in an economic war over Kansas City, where people were basically moving across the street to get, you know, massive tax subsidies from the other state. And it was this kind of beggar thy neighbor economic development where they were, these corporations were just making money off of the taxpayers. The business didn't even really matter much. And, you know, being able to see and weigh whether it's worth the investment of state money and taxpayer money to have the company move across the street, I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, and it was happening there to such a big degree, but it happens all the time everywhere. You see it all the time with the New York, New Jersey border, where companies will threaten to leave Manhattan or they'll threaten to leave New Jersey to go to New York. And, you know, it's really all you're paying for a worker to change their commute. You're not creating new jobs. You're not creating new industry. And so that's what you're paying for. We talked to one site selection consultant who told us that their company used to scour 10Ks of company business filings, business reports to see if any big leases were about to expire. So then they could reach out to the company and say, your lease is about to expire. Let me help you get a subsidy to either stay put, i.e. threats of leaving, or to just move you a little bit where you might be able to get a subsidy nearby. So it's a, it is a, a poor strategy, right, when you're thinking about economic development.
Actually. So let me ask you on this side of it then, because, you know, a lot of people are saying, why should we be subsidizing corporations at all? And look, I'm getting this a lot from people because I've taken this position for a long time. Now that Biden is reshoring some manufacturing and we're bringing back strategically some production and chip manufacturing and other places, you know, I'm saying, look, you know, sadly, we have to subsidize this to get it off the ground. But generally, I'm opposed to it. What do you say to that frame?
Well, you know, we've never been opposed to subsidies. The reason that we seem to be so critical of them is because so many of the deals are so poorly structured that you can't help but be critical of them because they aren't going to create new jobs. They aren't going to, a lot of times, we're subsidizing minimum wage jobs that Amazon's creating or just barely above minimum wage. So, but I think subsidies that are thoughtful and are meant to fill a gap we're supportive of them. I mean, when you think about what a subsidy, what an incentive truly is, it's to entice behavior that wouldn't otherwise happen. Most of the time, what we see is a subsidy, right? The behavior would happen anyway. But I think when you're talking about creating a new industry, like what's happening with this federal legislation, or when you're talking about, you know, for example, putting a healthy grocery store in a food desert, or paying for people who are returning from being incarcerated and getting them into some job training programs, those are economic development incentives that we support.
And not just handing off checks to big corporations who are looking for the highest handout. You know, I always go back to, in my neighborhood, there was a factory here, Carlisle Tire and Wheel, had been here for like 95, 98 years. And the state of Tennessee gave them millions of dollars, lured them away with a whole bunch of free stuff. They didn't create any new jobs. They didn't make anything different. They didn't make anything new. They simply went to another state, paid lower wages, and made higher corporate profits. Don't know how that helped the taxpayers. And that's my problem with a lot of these subsidies. I'm not against incentivizing or investing, but you know, these handouts. And this is where I think, with it being Sunshine Week, maybe we stop some of that.
Yeah, I mean, now's as good a time as ever to stop that kind of behavior that you're talking about, which is moving jobs from one state to another, which is a loser's game, ultimately, especially when you go from a place that was paying good union wages to a place that's paying right-to-work state wages,
yep,
which are lower.
No, that was right here. I mean, those were steel worker jobs here locally, as I remember, and you went down to No Rights at Work, Tennessee, and, well, almost half the wage they paid to those workers down there. The company made a whole bunch of money, a lot of profit for them, but a screw job for everybody else. So last question I've got for you, with it being Sunshine Week, what's the action? What are the marching orders for folks? What can we do in different states across the country to ensure that maybe our state does better than 64? Maybe we get a state to 65. That would be a win.
Well, I think in a lot of these places, it's very, the dogma that economic development incentives create jobs is very popular. Even people who have real ideas about thoughtful economic development sometimes believe that line because they've never really stopped to think about it. But what people can do everywhere across the country is, hey, a company's coming in, they're getting some kind of incentive, you've heard, they're getting some kind of a subsidy, they're really excited and celebrating it. We wish the public would go and ask for that deal. What are the workers getting? What are they going to be paid? How come we don't get to know about this dollar figure before the project is approved? Can we see any kind of documents? Can we get the contract even after it's approved? But I think if the public asks these questions and demands some answers, I think that's where you start to see some change. You know, Nevada was really prompted. The reason that Nevada has better transparency than a lot of places now is because there was a lot of uproar, public uproar around the Tesla deal that went to Nevada that was so huge in 2014. And the public said, hey, we're giving Elon Musk billions of dollars. What are we getting? And they really demanded this transparency that continues today.
Maybe that's what it takes in every state. Maybe where should we go? And maybe with the idea of weighing, are these subsidies or these handouts we're giving to corporate America, to people like Elon Musk, are they worth lost revenue for our libraries or for, you know, people taking care of people with developmental disabilities or the public school as a whole, or healthcare or anything? There are many opportunities to spend money in better ways, in my view. But Arlene, I appreciate you sharing some time with us, enjoying this sunshine week. I hope folks will get active and do something about it.
Thanks, Rick. Me too. Have a great day.
You as well, our good friend Arlene Martinez. Make sure you check out their website, goodjobsfirst.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1930. That was the day that Mahatma Gandhi began his famous Salt March. The march was to protest British colonial rule of India and the repressive salt tax waged on the Indian people. Under British rule, Indian people were prohibited from producing salt. They were required to purchase expensive British salt that was heavily taxed. Gandhi brought international attention to this injustice with a 240-mile march to the city of Dandi on the coast of the Arabian Sea. Dozens of supporters of the cause began the march with Gandhi. As the march passed through villages, and more joined the trek and gathered to hear Gandhi speak. They reached the sea by April 5th. The next day, the marchers scooped up salt deposits from the shore in defiance of the British salt regulations. For the next 2 months, Gandhi continued to organize salt protests. He planned a march on large salt works, but was arrested before it began. In his absence, some 2,500 protesters picked up and carried out the actions. The marchers were brutally beaten by police. In total, 60,000 people were arrested during the campaign. Gandhi was held for more than 6 months until his release was negotiated. The non-violent civil disobedience of Gandhi and his followers were key to dismantling the British colonial system in India. Their courage also served as an inspiration to the labor movement and civil rights movement in the United States. A. Philip Randolph, the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, was one such labor leader inspired by the action. He planned his march on Washington to protest discrimination in hiring during World War II, in part based on the Indian example. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, talking to Arlene got me thinking about the whole debacle that happened in my neighborhood. It's got to be, it's got to be 10 years, 11 years ago. Now, the good thing, honestly, you know, and this is one of those things where you go, you know, the good thing out of this is they took the property where Carlisle Tire and Wheel had been, and they turned it into a lot of low-cost housing, a lot of high-density living. So some low-wage working people have a nice place to live. But it took the borough, and it took some state money, and took a lot of effort to clean up that property and to make that property, well, into what it is now, which is, you know, fabulous. It worked out in the best for the community, in that, you know, you took what was going to be an eyesore, what was going to be, you know, a place that probably in 100 years would still be just crumbling, and you turned it into something productive. So they took what was a bad situation, and, well, what was that? What's that saying? They made, you know, lemonade out of lemons, and that's what they did, and good on them. But the reality is you lost a lot of good-paying jobs for people in the community by this company just going, hey, you know, Tennessee's offering millions of dollars. You know, basically going to pay our move, going to give us land, give us all kinds of sweeteners and incentives to fatten our bottom line. And oh, by the way, we get to get away from the union and these workers and, you know, that we've, you know, the ones who made us profitable. And we get to go down and exploit a cheaper labor force. And it's what they did. And look, it's not just them. It's the corporate mindset. What used to be, hey, you know, location, 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 is now, yeah, location, but the location's got to come with massive welfare handouts. And, you know, the fact that, you know, as Arlene and their group pointed out, those come with opportunity costs. And I was saying this back in 2012, 2013, when this was going on, that, look, the money that this business generated in local tax revenue, you know, to help the schools, the wages that they're paid and the taxes that get paid, you know, to the borough and to the state and to the local school system, all that's going to be lost. And is the incentives worth what's being produced? Now, the state of Pennsylvania offered, you know, millions of dollars to say, no, here's some millions so that you'll stay. But it wasn't enough. And what we've allowed to happen, now again, I am not against helping companies get that foothold by investing in them, getting some benefit of creating a new industry. I'm not against that. I'm not against the idea of investing. Where I'm upset and I get angry is the fact that we're just handing out millions of dollars to basically attract a company that wants to just go for somewhere else. Hey, there's money to be had. And, you know, the folks at Good Jobs First, you know, they've done a lot of reporting on this over the years about how, you know, there are certain businesses where it's their business model to every so often, you know, get up and, you know, yeah, we're going to go across the street. And we as taxpayers have never really been, we've never really been in that conversation because clearly we don't get all the information. It's usually done. And then we see a ribbon cutting ceremony or, you know, there's the downside of it. The community gets the notice of, oh, hey, there's 600 workers going to lose their livelihoods. We're going to be left with this eyesore in our community that we've put up with all these years because it generated revenue for the community and income for workers. I like the idea of more transparency. I like the idea of putting this stuff out and having some clawback ability to where, okay, we're going to invest some money in you. We're going to invest some money in creating a new industry. I was not 100% against the Foxconn deal until I heard the details. And then you go, wait a minute, that's a bit much. Now, they did have, if you remember, they did have, well, they're going to be 13,000 jobs. And then they say, well, no, it's going to be 5,000 jobs. And then, well, no, it's going to be less than that. And you start going, it's not what we were promised. That's not what we invested in. That's not why we took money from education and from healthcare and from roads and bridges and anything else. And we gave it to corporate special interests to go, hey, we can do better. Now, understand, I have taken a beating recently over my support of Biden's infrastructure bill and the CHIPS Act, because we are giving subsidies, especially in the CHIPS Act, to companies to come and reshore manufacturing. I don't like it, but you have to do it in this moment. It is what it is. We paid for them to leave in a lot of cases. And sadly, we've got to pay for them to come back. But I think what you have to do, and I think Biden has done this, especially on the construction end of it, is you do have to put those things in it that says, no, we've got to benefit from this. And there's got to be a way for corporate America to pay back what it is they're getting in subsidies. Which is why it's weird to me that, you know, the Republicans keep talking about, you know, we need more corporate tax cuts and all of that, where we should be going, no, if we're giving you money, we should be getting that money back. We should be taxing corporate America, you know, kind of like Dwight Eisenhower did. You know, since, you know, our great socialist president, I keep arguing we should be going back to his tax code. I look at this as an opportunity. Start taxing corporate America like we did during Ike's era, 56%. And maybe start going after, you know, the individuals, you know, our high earners, the ones who pocket all of this wealth. Start going after them. Maybe like Ike did in 1953, 92% top marginal tax rate. Yeah, That's what it was. And you wonder how we paid for our wars, and we still had money to fund the GI Bill so people could buy homes. And we had a, you wonder how college was affordable and healthcare wasn't backbreaking. You wonder. Huh. Maybe we get there again. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. And as always, appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.